but the chemical and the refining industry have always demonstrated year over year efficiency improvements, cost reductions continually. And I don't see why that would change. We are at the very infancy of e-fuels, and I expect a lot more improvements to happen over time.
Welcome to Sustainability in the Air, the world's first podcast dedicated to sustainable aviation. I'm your host, Shashank Nigam, the CEO of Simply Flying. Every Thursday, I have important conversations with top aviation executives, technology entrepreneurs, and policymakers helping aviation take climate action. Conversations that help separate the signal from the noise. Whether you are a frequent flyer or an airline executive, if you care about sustainability or simply love traveling, welcome aboard. My guest today is Amy Hubbard. Amy is the CEO of Arcadia eFuels. Arcadia has been making lots of strides in making e-fuels for the world's airlines. They have a new plant coming up in Denmark. They are negotiating large deals with airlines and other players around the world. And Amy herself has not just a chemical engineering background, but also lots of experience working in this business, having previously been with Topsoe. Amy sheds light into what it takes to scale a growing, fledgling e-fuels company like Arcadia. Amy, welcome to the show. Let's start by you telling us a little bit about yourself. What was the journey that led you into the world of sustainable aviation fuels, and in particular, e-fuels, which is rather new, isn't it?
It is. It's a brand new product to the market. I think we just really woke up one day and we're like, why is no one producing carbon neutral fuels? The technology basically exists. And we just looked around and we couldn't understand why no one was doing it. So we said, look, we feel the sense of urgency. We need to get out there. We need to rapidly bring carbon neutral fuels to the hard to abate aviation and long haul trucking sector.
Why was no one doing it? Did you find out?
I don't know. I was just fortunate that I worked at some companies where I knew that the technology was available, right? So it's pretty well known gas to liquids technology where you convert natural gas into the same products, you know, diesel and kerosene, right? And then with green hydrogen starting to take off and people developing more and more mature electrolyzers, you know, you can substitute natural gas with green hydrogen and then captured CO2. So I was like, wow, you know, just looking around, what's happening? So people were talking about doing e-methanol or e-ammonia and of course, you know, green hydrogen, but there was no talk about doing diesel and kerosene. So we said, okay, this is it. Someone has to do this, so we'll go make it happen.
Wow, that's very interesting that you spotted this gap in the market, so to say. Lots of terms already, lots of industry-specific terms in the first few minutes already. Explain it to me like I'm five. What is an e-fuel? What does Arcadia do?
Yeah, so basically fuels are just hydrogen and carbon atoms, you know, arranged in a certain way to make either diesel, kerosene, gasoline, whatever fuels you may want to use. So basically you just take renewable electricity and water, and using electrolysis, you separate the hydrogen from the oxygen from water. Then you take the hydrogen forward. You know, the problem of the world is there's too much CO2 in the air, in the atmosphere. So there's people that are capturing the CO2 emissions, either from a biogenic source, of course, direct air capture, and also, of course, a fossil source. So we can buy that CO2 that people have captured. Then we have our carbon source and we have our hydrogen source. And then we mix the carbon and hydrogen in a syngas reactor to arrange the molecules in the right way. Then we take it forward to a Fischer-Tropsch crude reactor, and then we do refining just like you would see at any other normal refinery, and then the products come out. So actually, it sounds very easy when you just explain it like that.
Well, that's what I asked you to do. you actually explained it like that. Now, I've previously had a few other e-fuel company CEOs on this show, like Air Company. I've got 12 coming up. How is your fuel different? What is what you're doing different from others?
We are all about getting to market fast and getting to market at a decent scale. And so we're not building pilot plants. We're not building, demo units because the technology is there. So we are all about, it's there on a smaller scale in terms of electrolyzers and of course, in terms of syngas reaction, But those are scaled up through multiplication. So in other words, with electrolysis, you know, if you have, just as an example, we're not doing this, but if you have a 1 megawatt unit and you want to make 10 megawatt, you just put 1 units in parallel. So it's called multiplication. That's the same thing we're doing with syngas reaction, which is fully electrified. I think that's another thing that sets us apart. We're not using any fossil inputs, even for the heat of the plant. So it's a fully electrified plant, start to finish. And then we're able to scale down the gas to liquids technology. So we're able to produce about 100 million liters per year of e-fuels and save about 250,000 tons per year of CO2 emissions.
Is this for biodiesel or is this for sustainable aviation fuels?
This is for e-kerosene or e-SAF or e-sustainable aviation fuel, whatever you want to call it, yes.
Are you selling these to airlines yet?
Yeah, so it's really tricky. I think that it's been an interesting journey on the offtake side. Everybody, of course, wants to buy these fuels. Of course, they're mandated starting in 2030, you know, Europe-wide. But the trick is, you know, as a company like ours, we don't have a huge balance sheet. So we need to go out and raise this money from debt and equity investors. Well, debt and equity investors typically require, you know, 12-year take-or-pay offtake agreements for the products. And so it's been pretty fun going to companies, airlines, and fuel distributors saying, please sign up for a take-or-pay agreement in 2023. We'll start supplying you products in 2027. And you have to buy from us no matter what happens in the market, no matter what happens with mandates until 2039. Please sign right here.
How do you convince the airline executive to actually sign then?
Well, I think, it's been funny, but there's been a big education. So when we started this a couple of years ago, it was more of an education like, oh, wait, what are e-fuels? What is this? And then, you know, now the mandates have passed, you know, this summer. But when we started 2 years ago, there was not even talk of mandates. So we were doing a lot of education at the beginning. Now with mandates, the understanding in the industry is much better. People get it. They understand that, you know, e-fuels and e-kerosene, basically, it's a carbon neutral fuel. So you have almost zero emissions when the airlines use them. So other forms of SAF, like BioSAF or HEFA-SAF, you know, they're somewhere between 40 and 60% CO2 emission reduction. So we're trying to explain, hey, yes, of course, like HEFA and bio is maybe 3-4 times the price of fossil fuels. And yes, maybe e-fuels are like, say, double the price of HEFA or HVO. But from a CO2 emission reduction perspective, the price, if you look at it, the pricing that way, we're kind of in line with those things. So I think it's people are like, oh, yeah. And then, of course, this carbon tax becomes more of a thing. And airlines are looking at, wait, if I have a penalty, if I'm not buying e-fuels, and if I have a carbon tax on every fossil molecule I buy, I better sign up with these e-fuel producers. And how do I get my hands on this product, right? So times are completely changing. It's just that airlines have always bought fuels on a one-year basis. You know, they sign up for a one-year commitment and now are saying, oh, no, you need 12 years and you can't start taking it until we build the plant 3 years later. So it's a different world now.
It seems like you're trying to change mindsets here, the way business is done, typically in the airline industry. I recently was speaking with an airline's head of sustainability, and she is from Europe, and she says she was bemoaning the fact that, oh, in the US, because of IRA, airlines can get their SAF so cheap, it's almost at par with Jet A, whereas in Europe and other parts of the world, it's not the case. Do you think price parity can be achieved? Will it be achieved? How long will it take?
I'm not sure price parity will be achieved. If you strip out taxes and incentives, I'm not sure price parity will be achieved, at least not in the next, you know, 15 years, right? That's kind of our horizon. So, but I don't think we should be thinking about it that way, because we cannot afford to continue to fly on fossil fuels. We cannot. So the alternatives either stop flying, which we do not advocate. We believe that the world should be connected and people should travel and experience new things. So then the option is, okay, how do we decarbonize aviation? A drop in fuel like ESAF is the best. Just no new infrastructure, no new engine development, you know, let's put the money there to, you know, the fuel here. I think, you know, long-term hydrogen airplanes or, you know, very short-haul electric airplanes, that can fill some gap, but that's a long way away. Now, I'll totally applaud people working on that now, because if you don't work on it now, we'll never get there. So that's fantastic. But again, we're not going to be seeing those in a broad way anytime soon. I think, you know, from the U.S. perspective, it is fantastic with the IRA. It really helps a lot. You know, $3 a kilogram green hydrogen credit is significant. We're still waiting on the final rules and how you qualify. Hopefully those will be coming out in November. So we're anxiously awaiting those. But I have a feeling they'll be, you know, they'll be achievable and fair. So that's fantastic. And Europe is really, it's just frustrating. And this is why I think when we go to, out to our customers, we can't quote a price now that has incentives built in for Europe. Now, we may apply for incentives and incentives may come down the road, but we're asking someone to sign up now with no incentives. And that's tough. It's tough for everyone.
Well, incentives or not incentives, you must be aware that Lufthansa CEO Carsten Spohr recently said that using e-fuels for Lufthansa would use up half of Germany's, the country's, electricity supply. How do you respond to a claim like that, that e-fuels are far too resource intensive?
Yeah, that's really interesting because, you know, I look back at when the first computer was ever built, right? It took up a whole building and could do one thing, right? And people didn't say, oh, yeah, we should never develop computers because, you know, no one will be able to use them. No, people said, hey, let's get in here. Let's make this happen. And, you know, look where we are today with technology. I'm not suggesting we can get that kind of progress in e-fuels, but for sure there'll be improvements made. I mean, let's take, you know, the solar panel that was developed back in the early 2000s. It was clunky, it was heavy, wasn't very efficient. And now the solar panels are much, much more efficient. So even from just a wind and solar distribution area, those will continue to become more efficient, continue to produce more electricity. Then you go to the grid. Right now there's wind and solar being produced that can't be used. It's just being wasted because the grid can't handle the inputs. And so that's a shame, right? And then you have just the electrolyzers themselves. Okay, electrolyzers have been around 100 years making KOH, but for hydrogen, this is relatively new. They're not that efficient yet. They will be over time, right? Even this, you know, new generation of SOEC is much more efficient than alkaline and PEM. It needs some time to scale up and mature, but it will. It absolutely will. And PEM and alkaline will continue to scale. So I really feel that, yes, probably, if you look at it on today's basis and where we are, of course, it doesn't really make sense if you think that there's never going to be any improvements. But the chemical and the refining industry have always demonstrated year over year efficiency improvements, cost reductions continually. And I don't see why that would change. We are at the very infancy of e-fuels, and I expect a lot more improvements to happen over time.
Thank you. I appreciate the positivity. In fact, I remember, I think, seeing that first computer. It's at it's in Boston at MIT. They still have it housed in a huge room, and it's on display. So it does ring a bell from my days living in Cambridge, Mass. The other aspect of this is not just demand, it's around cost. It costs a lot to put a plant in. You know, a project like the one you're talking about needs an awful lot of capital investment. You also need time, as the infrastructure and refineries really don't exist right now.
Correct.
There are very few refineries that can deal with SAF globally right now. How do you overcome these challenges, and what are some of the numbers that, you know, for you, if you're able to share?
Well, the existing refineries today are very large scale, right? So 200,000 barrels per day. They can't process a very small amount of either Fischer-Tropsch crude or even green hydrogen. It just gets lost in the system, right? So what's going to take this market, what the market needs to really take off are some smaller scale projects like ours. So even though I say ours is probably one of the largest, you know, it's still 2,000 barrels a day. So we have to start somewhere. Making 20 barrels a day really, to me, doesn't make any impact. 2,000 is a start. And then as we get more and more experience and electrolyzers mature, and like I was mentioning with the grid being more stable, then we can scale up to, you know, 60,000 barrels, eventually 200,000 barrels a day, right? But we're not there yet. So the cost will come down. You asked about parity. That I don't know, but I'm confident the cost will come down over time. But we need the support today. If we just sit and think about it and do paper studies, the cost won't come down. Just like with wind and solar, people had to build solar panels, build wind farms, get them up and running, then make the improvements and make the improvements. Same with the computer analogy. People didn't just say, oh, on paper, you know, how can we invent an iPhone? No, they made incremental improvements over time, and that's how things take shape. And I think that'll be the same way with e-fuels.
It's interesting. I'm wondering, are you able to share how much SAF are you producing today?
Nothing. And we're not doing anything.
Nothing, right?
Blowing through money on engineering costs to get our design. Our design is finalized. We're now in basically the thick of the engineering to build the plant.
And when do you think you will produce a first drop of SAF?
Once we get these offtake agreements in place, if we can get those like the timing we think, then it'll be end of 26, early 27.
Okay. And Are you relying primarily on offtake agreements? Do you foresee book and claim and other methodologies play a role here?
I do. I think the book and claim is a great system. I think that it's still really new, and I think it's working okay on, you know, SAF production, because SAF is, you know, HVO and BioSAF is being produced, so that works. But again, a book and claim system where we're asking someone, it's the same thing. You're still asking to commit to buy in 2027. You're asking them to commit today to buy in 27 and buy continually until 2039. You know, it's an interesting dilemma.
How do you convince? I mean, for the audience here, you used to be an executive at Topsoil before you started Arcadia eFuels. How do you change mindsets? How do you convince an airline executive? For fun, let's have this. I am the CEO of an airline. I have been mandated by my government to have 30% SAF in a few years. And now I'm talking to you. How would you convince me when I'm used to buying one-year contracts and that too hedged for jet fuel?
Well, there's two things. You know, airlines are very concerned about cost. And thank goodness, because we all like to buy airplane tickets at the best prices. So that's good. We like their focus on cost. But if they don't conform to the mandates and the penalty that's being discussed today passes, which is the difference between the e-fuel price and fossil fuel for a price times two, that is a significant penalty. And so this could actually bankrupt airlines if they're not careful. Actually the airlines don't get the penalty. The fuel distributors get the penalty, but you know, the fuel distributors will just hike up the price to airlines. So it is something that I think airlines are very aware of. And even though they haven't been really in this fuels business, they've relied on fuel distributors. They're now getting very well educated and they understand this. I think there's also an angle for airlines, not just on the cost side, but also they see this as a new market opportunity. You know, being able to appeal to business customers and just individuals that want to travel responsibly and are willing to pay a slight premium for a carbon neutral fuel. So this is something that I think a lot of these savvy airlines are now investigating. The unfortunate thing is that there's been a little confusion today with the offsets, right? So now some airlines, you can go in and buy an offset and people are like, are they really planting a tree somewhere? Or is this just a scam? People don't know. But in the future with e-fuels, we'll be able to say, hey, here's a certificate. This certificate is proof. The airlines could then transfer those certificates to their business customers if they wanted. It's like this book and claim system, right? So I think this is where there's going to be a lot of interesting inventions and a lot of interesting processes that will develop in the future. And these savvy airlines that look forward will be successful.
Right. One of the reasons why e-fuels cost more is because, like you explained the whole chemical process earlier, it requires green hydrogen, or ultimately will require green hydrogen. But over 95% of the world's hydrogen is coming from fossil fuel sources today. So where do you hope to get sufficient quantities of green hydrogen?
Well, we've had to build green hydrogen ourselves, you know, because there was no one really looking. There's a lot of talk around green hydrogen, but there actually weren't a lot of projects being built at the scale we needed. You may have seen, we just announced that we ordered a 280 megawatt electrolyzer from Plug Power. So we're looking at a pretty significant size electrolyzer to make these e-fuels. So we are not opposed to buying hydrogen in the future, but from the time frame we need, we just weren't seeing enough people building their own. I understand now that there are people are being challenged to even just build green hydrogen because same problem, bankability, getting an off-taker for 12 years on the hydrogen side, right? So this whole industry is doing a fantastic job from the technical development, but we're really needing some support, all of it, green hydrogen, e-methanol, everything. You know, we need some support to make these products a reality from the government. And the government's demonstrated this. They supported solar. Many of the European governments, especially Germany, right, supported wind and solar in the early 2000s. So this is not a new concept. And it doesn't go on forever. It just gets it off the ground.
Exactly. You mentioned offtake agreements. Are you able to share with us who you are working with in terms of potential customers, both airlines and non-airlines?
You know, we talk to almost everyone, right? And I think that it's really interesting when you look around. I mean, we actually early on made some announcements and you know, had a little fluffy, you know, letters of intent or whatever. We stopped signing those things, right? And we stopped announcing what we're doing because if you don't have a binding agreement, it doesn't mean anything. And so it's really funny when you read some of these announcements, they're all like, oh, partnership. Oh, we'll investigate in the future. And it's not like a take or pay, right? Binding agreement. So we can't really announce who we're working with today because we're in those discussions right now and hopefully these final negotiations to get this over the finish line.
That's interesting because I do know a lot of SAF companies and other new technology companies who rely on letters of intent to then raise investment to then build the product, which can then turn into an MOU or something else. Why are you shying away from letters of intent? Have you not seen that to be helpful?
Well, yes, the letters of intent helped us raise our development funding. So we had to raise, you know, significant money in order to do the engineering. I mean, this is not a cheap situation. You know, like you're looking at almost 50 million euros just for the engineering and the development, right? So you needed to we needed to show there was a market, fine. But now you can't just do that on letters of intent, right? That needs to be fully binding agreements or some creative financing. So if anyone has any creative financing ideas, we're all ears.
So creative financing, let's talk about that. What about corporates? I know the likes of Microsoft and Salesforce and Cisco and Google, they are, you know, betting big on having their employees and they're looking at their scope 3 emissions where there is a sharp focus. Is that on the cards for you, signing deals with large corporates even before?
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. But that requires a book and claim system to be available today so you can actually put the terms together for a binding agreement.
And do you have to build your own book and claim system? How does that
work? You're not going to do that. I mean, that's, you know, look, we have enough challenges already. We're not going to try to take over everything in the supply chain. I'm confident that there'll be really innovative companies that can come up with this book and claim system that works for everyone, right?
Right. You're, of course, working on building a plant in Denmark currently. Run us through the process of what happens here when you build a plant. What happens after that? And what's the vision for the next 5 to 10 years there?
Yeah, so to meet the 2030 mandate in Europe, it will require roughly 10 manufacturing plants the size of ours in Denmark. So that's a significant number of plants that need to be brought online in 2030.
Only in Denmark?
Well, no. In the world.
In all of Europe. Okay.
10 plants anywhere in the world that can supply the European Union in 2030. Right. But that's a lot, I would say. It's, you know, we've been working on this a couple of years. I know others working on it. Some people are talking about getting to the same scale we are, but, you know, can 10 plants get up and running 2030? We'll see, right? It all comes down to what's bankable and how do we get these under construction. But we have, you know, we feel that a burning platform here, we want to take advantage of the IRA in the U.S. So we have a site that we're developing in the U.S. We also have some good news for another country that we're working in that we'll be announcing something on that in the next few weeks. So we're constantly looking across the world. Where is the best place to build these e-fuel plants that can still be RF and BO compliant and that can still offer the best cost to our customers to meet these mandates? So that's we're all about continually developing our pipeline. We have a really good strategy with our, not strategy, but we have a really good design of our plant. It's pretty cost efficient. We have people that have worked in gas and liquids plants. They know what they're doing. So we have a pretty compelling situation. It's just all about getting electricity price at the appropriate levels.
It's very interesting. One of the questions I usually like to end my interviews with is, what gives you the most hope for the future of sustainable aviation?
The most hope. Let's see. I believe that, you know, right now there's a 50% blending requirement for the product we're making, which is the FT-SPK specification. You know, I believe that it's going to change. And I believe that airlines will be able to fly on 100% ESAF, that we can fly carbon neutral. We won't have any guilt about getting on airplanes. That is my hope, that we can continue to connect the world to each other and do it in a responsible way and do it in a cost-efficient way.
It's certainly my hope, trying to get a lot of these perspectives out there on sustainable aviation. The last part of this interview is a bit more fun, what I call the rapid fire round, in which we get to know you over a bit more personally. And I will ask you a simple, short question, and you can reply in a single answer, in a single word or a short phrase. Let me start something with simple. What's your favorite airline?
Oh, God. Actually, Delta.
Okay. Are you in Atlanta? No, you're in Austin. You're in Texas.
I'm in Austin, and I grew up in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And so you could only fly, you know, there was only 3 airlines that flew out. And basically going to Europe or going to the Northeast, you flew through Atlanta. And I went to school in Atlanta. I went to Georgia Tech, so Atlanta feels like home. And
Well, we got that easy one out of the way. What about your favorite book?
Atlas Shrugged. Okay. Or actually, I don't know, The Epic Quest of Oil, Money, and Power. That's awesome. Daniel Yergin. That was one of my favorite books. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for that recommendation. I think a lot of the listeners of this podcast will enjoy that one. What's your favorite movie?
Star Wars. All the Star Wars.
Wow. Okay, a Star Wars fan. Your
Anything
favorite city?
Science fiction.
And your favorite city?
Well, I'm new to Austin, but so far I really like it. It's a fantastic city. It's so different from, you know, Houston and Dallas. It's got its own little culture here in Austin. Love that. But I also love Amsterdam. I lived in Amsterdam for a few years. Fantastic city. I don't know. These questions are hard because there's so many amazing cities. Tokyo and Seoul. And
all right. We'll stick with Austin, your new home. What is something that you want to learn?
Always looking to learn new things. I would say if I could do anything and snap my fingers and have the knowledge, it would really be around electricity and just all the electrical pieces that go into this new world of wind and solar, electrolyzers, grids, transformers.
Wow, you are quite the geek, Amy. I hear about people trying to learn languages or music or dance. You are a true blue engineer. Georgia Tech would be proud for you being an alum. What do you do in your free time?
Well, I have four children and now one granddaughter. So I spend a lot of time with family and my downtown family and friends.
Okay. The best advice you received?
Best advice I received is if you want a job, start doing the job. If you work in a company or even like this startup, if you wanted to see something happen, just go do it. Don't wait for someone to say, would you like to go start an e-fuels company?
Would you like
to be promoted to the next level in your corporation? No, you just start doing the job you want to do and then it'll be yours. Best advice ever.
Very good. Very good advice. Thank you for sharing. What if we speak a year from now and we are popping champagne? What are we celebrating?
We're celebrating the FID, final investment decision for our first site.
Okay. Well, I do wish you all the best for that. And I have been seeing a lot of the traction you've been making, Denmark and elsewhere. And I'm hoping to soon fly on an airline that is carrying some e-fuel from Arcadia. You're on quite the journey, and I'm really excited for you, Amy. Thank you very much for sharing.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Sustainability in the Air. Aviation is one of the hardest to decarbonize industries, yet there are multiple paths to get to net zero. Awareness is key to a green future. So please give us your support to help our sustainable aviation insights reach a wider audience. You can do this by sharing this episode on your network, on LinkedIn, Twitter, or even WhatsApp. Or perhaps you might consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to this episode. You can start a conversation with us by writing to us at podcast@simplifying.com. And for more content on sustainable aviation, please visit our website green.simplifying.com and join the movement. Sustainability in the Air is an original podcast by Simplifying. The show is produced by Juraj Toth in Slovakia. Dirk Singer is our Director of Sustainability, who leads research for each interviewee out of Greenwich, UK. Shubhadeep Pal is our supervising editor based out of Mumbai and Singapore. The articles are written by Ayushi Badola in Dehradun in India and Mira Hull in Montreal, Quebec. Creative design is led by Ligia Esteve in Montreal. Baiba Dreamain is the project director for the show based out of Valencia, Spain. Special thanks to Wendy Sim in Singapore. And I'm Shashank Nigam, the CEO of Simplifying and your host. Please feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn.